Hello, and welcome to the Locus Roundtable Podcast. Today, I'm taking advantage of the fact that John Scalzi is on a book tour stop here in Houston. So this is one of the rare non-con-related live Locus podcasts. John, if you'd say hello.
Hello, John. Oh, wait, no, that's not right. Hi, everybody. It's John Scalzi.
So this is the first week of your book tour?
It is the first week of the book tour. I started it on Wednesday in Philadelphia, and this is the fourth stop. Before that, I had a few days in BEA. I was actually there for Tuesday, which was when Red Shirts actually came out. So that was June 5th. Today was June 9th. So yeah, that's right. I'm already beginning to lose track. I did get up today, and I was like, wait, which day is this? It's Saturday. Okay, it's Saturday. All right, I know where I am.
Yeah, you must get really quickly into the, it's Tuesday, this must be Belgium.
Yes, it's exactly what it is. It is awfully disorienting because really what I do is I travel, I stop, I get picked up, I have a little bit of time just before the event to sort of collect myself. I do the event, I go back, I sleep, I wake up, and you just wash, rinse, repeat. And all those songs that they do in rock and roll about being on the road actually turn out to be kind of true, except this is on sort of the minor league level of that.
And then one thing I was also sorry about, when I saw that you were coming down here, and then I saw you were literally here just for, you know, between, like, noon and noon, was that you don't get a chance to, for instance, see NASA's Johnson Space Center, which is right here.
It's really a disappointment. The funny thing is, of course, when I'm touring, because this is actually the third book tour I've done, and I tell people I'm coming to Houston, or I'm coming to Chicago, or I'm going to LA, and they immediately fill my Twitter feed and email with, "Oh, you have to go here. Oh, you have to go here." I'm like, "No, you don't understand. I'm here to perform like a monkey for several hours, and then I go to sleep because I have to go somewhere else." So it's you don't do a whole lot of sightseeing, unfortunately. But on the other hand, you do get to see a lot of people, which is nice.
Absolutely. So when you started out as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever imagine you'd have book tours like this? This does not seem like the normal course of events.
I have to tell you, I was very surprised. I was just mentioning, actually, out on the tour that I've become... I used to be a writer, but now I'm a dude who travels a lot and then also occasionally writes because book tours, which are, you know, I will be on... it's a 16-stop book tour, so it's fairly intensive, and it's a lot of travel time. And that doesn't count BEA at the beginning of it, and it doesn't count a convention fan fest in Louisville at the end of it. So it's just a huge amount of time. And then I travel at least once a month for other related things, and that takes usually several days out of my schedule as well. And it's the thing that the more popular you become, the more people want you to go and do stuff. And in one sense, it's very cool because, you know, you do actually get to see places and you get to meet people that you don't always get to meet. And I have a lot of writer friends, so, like, we will, you know, say, who's going to ALA this year? And there will be several of them. It was like, oh, great, let's get together, because that's when we'll get to see each other. So it's not like it's horrible, but at the same time, it's like somewhere in there, you actually have to write something else because you have to be on the cycle of let's try to get a book out at least once a year. So it really is. It really has been a surprise to me how much of my life now relates to not writing. And, you know, Paolo Galuppi and I were talking about this, and he's mentioning that Pat Rothfuss and I have talked about this, Neil Gaiman and I have talked about this, just about sooner or later you actually have to say, you know, I've got to take a break. And in fact, for 2013, you know, I've been getting invitations to go to conventions and conferences and stuff, and I basically turned them all down. I was like, 2013, I'm actually staying at home. I'm going to try to write as much as possible. Now, it's possible I might do a book tour in 2013. If tour asks me to go somewhere and pays me to go somewhere, I will. But mostly for the last 2 years, I've just been doing so much travel, I'm ready to be at home.
Now, switching tracks a little bit, when you started the book tour in Philadelphia, that was the same day that we all found out about Ray Bradbury.
Yes.
And you did a special...
Yeah, he obviously was a huge influence on me. I mean, I'd actually met him when I was 12. And so... And he's not just a huge influence on me, he's a huge influence on everyone. It's Ray Bradbury. He's a pillar. And so... I decided that for my Philadelphia stop, the first thing I was going to do, and I didn't tell anybody what I was going to do specifically, but I read There Will Come Soft Rains, which is from his Martian Chronicles, and I introduced it by basically saying there's something I have to do tonight. This is the only time on the tour that I'm going to be doing it, but I've got to do it, and I think you'll understand once I do it. And I started reading it, and everybody, you know, got it instantly. I mean, that's the nice thing about touring with science fiction people, is they get what you're doing and why. And there are a couple times I almost lost it, you know, just reading it, because, you know, it's Ray Bradbury. But they all went with me on that little ride, and I thought it went very well. And it was, you know, it was, like I said, it was something I felt I needed to do to mark the occasion, and still very sad about it.
Absolutely.
On the other hand, he was 91 years old, and what a life!
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, and I remember when we found out about his stroke almost 10 years ago, and we were like, "Oh no, that's going to be it." And he still.
Yeah. No.
You know, we were able to have 10 more years of him. That was wonderful.
Yeah. So, but it really is a closing of a door of a certain era. I mean, Frederick Pohl is still here. There are still a few others from the Golden Age who are of significance, but you know, it's hard to replace Bradbury, Heinlein, Clark, and Asimov. You know,
well, and even in fandom, when we lost Forry Ackerman,
right? Oh yes, exactly so, because he was, you know, he was the first among equals in fandom. So,
and that brings up something that I've noticed about your fiction, which is, there's a whole cohort of people who loved the Golden Age of science fiction and then stopped. You still run into people today who say, "Oh yeah, I used to love science fiction. I read, you know, Asimov, Clark, Heinlein, Bradbury," and then you ask, "Well, have you read anybody recently?" And they're like, "Oh, was the Hal Clement?" Like, oh yeah, he's new. A fresh young face there.
Yeah, I expect good things from that kid.
Yeah, but when. And actually, this happened to me at NASA. I'm working for a gentleman who is actually also a reader, which is rare enough in the world.
Sure.
Has also read science fiction. He is actually a stone-cold Hal Clement fan, owns every single Hal Clement novel ever. I was
sure.
Like, shine on, okay. And I threw him some Greg Egan, and he was like, that didn't click. But I gave him Old Man's War for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, "I read this in a night. Where can I get more of this?
Give me more of this. Give me more Scalzi. Get Scalzi on the line for me."
You know, and again, it seems to, your work seems to bridge that gap. And of course, then you did with, the
Fuzzy Nation.
Exactly. Which again, bridges that gap. And were you aiming for that sweet spot?
Well, I don't know that I was aiming for that sweet spot. I mean, what happened was when I wrote Old Man's War, what I was really trying to do was, one, I was trying to write something that I thought could sell. That was really an intentional thing on my part. And so I was like, well, military science fiction seems to sell pretty well. Maybe I'll try that. But then I was confronted with, I don't want to write something that I just think, well, this is how you go down the list. It's like, no, I'm going to write the military science fiction that I would like to read. And a lot of my reading initially was from the Golden Age as well. You know, I grew up reading the Heinlein Juveniles, and of course I read Clark, and obviously we read Bradbury, and all those fantastic books, and obviously as well H.P. and Piper. So they clearly had an influence on me, not just in the sort of, those were the stories that I liked, but what they shared in common, with the exception of Bradbury, who was a little bit off to the side there, was a clear prose style that was not... There are some writers, and Bradbury was the first of many, and then, of course, the British New Wave was filled with them, were people who were really experimenting with language and how that affected how the story was going on. But then there was what I call basically the Campbellian style after John Campbell, which is clear, declarative, you know, is a box to put the story into, and what you're looking at is the ideas rather than the words themselves. As a prose stylist, I tend more towards the sort of Campbellian style than the sort of Moorcockian British New Wave style. And I mean, that's obvious in the reading. I can do stuff in that line. That's why, one of the reasons why I did God Engines, is just say, by the way, I have this ability. But on a day-to-day basis, I tend to write more like the folks of old. And I think that that's fine. You know, one of the things about science fiction, that we've been fortunate, but which also has some ramifications, is we have some absolutely magnificent writers and stylists in science fiction and fantasy today who are as good writers as have ever been in the genre and can stand on the same level as any writer writing in any genre, including literary fiction. We have people who are just those good stylists. The flip side of that is that often one has to commit to getting up to speed with that particular style, with that particular author, and basically making a commitment to that. And if you do, you're amply rewarded. But some people just want to read a book and get lost for like 5 or 6 hours. And so where I think where I come in is that I am someone who is definitely a modern writer. I have modern sensibilities. One of the reasons why I did Fuzzy Nation was to take a golden age science fiction story and sort of put it into our time rather than to read it and have to go in knowing it's like, by the way, you have to accept that this was written in a social milieu in which women were still expected to be giving you the cocktails at 6 p.m. But at the same time, the whole idea is that it's meant to be accessible. I often say that the person I think of when I write my books is she's not the primary audience, but she keep her in mind, is my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law loves me, so she's going to read my books, and I don't want her to get lost. And she reads Julie Garwood and Nora Roberts and all that sort of stuff. So I want to write science fiction that has the ability to convey a number of ideas, but at the same time that my mother-in-law, who's not stupid, she's the pretty much almost average American, can read and enjoy. And so that is actually something that I aim for, is that the ability to get a story that and put it in such a way that even if you don't read science fiction, that you can see that as accessible. And if you like it, then you can try the deeper waters. You know what I mean? It's like, if you like me, the next step, you know, go ahead and try some Charlie Strauss or go ahead and try some China Mieville and see how you enjoy that. So,
okay, now I'm picturing people going from Old Man's War to
Perdita Street Station.
Perdita Street Station.
Maybe not directly.
Maybe not directly.
Maybe you go a few more steps in. But but the point of it is that...
But I can see going from you to Charlie Strauss.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, I do think that ecologically speaking, I fill a niche which is basically gateway stuff, that people who enjoy a story for a story, people who enjoy you know, a good story regardless of genre, or people who are interested in science fiction but feel like I haven't been reading it so I don't even know where to start, you know. And in some sort of sense, I mean, that there's positives and negatives about that. I mean, I think there is some critical apprehension that that I am science fiction on training wheels, which I don't know that's necessarily true, but it is certainly true that I make no bones about I want as many people as possible to read it, and if through that they get a love of the genre a little bit, it's all to the good.
And then have you noticed when you come to book signings, to conventions, is it speaking to the new generations as well? Because I'm thinking there's the older generation that used Asimov, Quark, and Heinlein as their gateway.
Right.
And they obviously love your stuff. And then there's the generation who used Ender's Game mm-hmm. as a gateway. And then there's the, you know, the millennials, and they may only know it from TV or video games.
Right.
How are you finding the generational?
It seems to be pretty broad spectrum. I mean, you saw the crowd here. It was there were some definite old line folks here. There were some folks who were my age, which is in the, you know, 30s, 40s. And then we had a fair number of people who are in their 20s as well.
And then you had the babies that are my baby's age.
Right, exactly.
And little Trekkie onesies.
Yeah, that was very, very cute. I don't count them as readers yet, so I don't think that I can claim them. But it is one of those things that I do believe I've been fortunate that I seem to get a wide range. They go, you know, they go old, they go young. It's not about a particular age group. So that makes me happy because, you know, hopefully as I go on, I will continue to have readers. So, and I don't know, it's hard to say. I mean, you hope that, I think every writer hopes that you get more than just a niche readership, that you get a broad spectrum of reader, and that those readers will also talk to other people going, hey, you should read this. So far, I mean, like I said, it seems like it's a good range of people. You never know. You just basically have to go with what you can see.
So another thing I've noticed is that since the Old Man's War universe, it seems like a lot of your work has moved to lighter tones, with the exception of God Engines, with the massive exception of God Engines there. It seems like you're having such good luck right now writing, you know, lighthearted, funny stuff that's still thoughtful. I mean, Red Shirts, I think, seems to walk that line really well. But for people who, for instance, looked at Ghost Brigades and went, wow, you can really delve into some of the philosophical issues, you know, do you feel moved to circle back to that at all? Or is the humor working? I mean, it's such a great niche. SF comedy is hard to do well and very popular when it's done well.
Yeah, well, comedy period is hard to do well.
Yeah.
And, you know, certainly we can talk about that. But I haven't intentionally gone for lighter fare in the sense of, you know, it's a 5-year plan to be funny or something like that. It's more that the particular projects that I've been interested in have lent themselves to a slightly lighter touch. And it certainly has paid off pretty well. I mean, Fuzzy Nation got onto the New York Times bestseller list. Red Shirts, I just haven't seen this sort of reaction for something I've written before, where literally my Twitter feed is, just finished it, it was awesome, I'm telling all my friends. I'm like, great! I'm totally down with that.
Yeah, that's like writer crack.
Exactly. You know, please tell me more that you love me. So in that sort of sense, it certainly seems to be successful. The next couple projects that I'm thinking about aren't necessarily meant to be funny. I mean, they will have light moments in them simply because that's just who I am, but they're not inherently meant to be funny. It's like I said, I don't want to give the impression that I think too hard about my career in the sense of what I'm going to do next. I have 6 or 7 ideas that are always rolling around in my head, and eventually one of them gets developed enough that it drops. And then when that one drops, it's like, okay, that's the next project. And sometimes it is something like, you know, God Engines, or sometimes it's something like Red Shirts.
Or the story about the yogurt.
Or the story about the yogurt. You know, the yogurt taking over the world. So it's just, a lot of it is just what matures in my brain. So far, the nice thing is that I haven't been too pigeonholed. I mean, people want another Old Man's War book. People want another Android's Dream book. Or some people want another Fuzzy book. But it seems like most people are willing to follow where I go with, you know, stuff. That it's about, you know, trusting me as an author as opposed to going, shut up and give us another Old Man's War. You know, I'm sure there are people who are just, shut up and give me another Old Man's War. But enough other people are out there that, you know, I don't feel compelled to track that. So I certainly like doing humor. And I think that science fiction in particular is finally at a point where we've moved out of the penumbra of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy sufficiently that you can be humorous in science fiction and people won't immediately say, oh, he's just trying to do that again. Because I have a bugaboo about, as much as I love Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it was an extinction level event for humor in science fiction. It really killed off doing humor for a really long time because it was so successful doing a certain thing. It's almost like Star Wars killed off a certain type of science fiction movie that it was really hard to maneuver out of that. I mean, when I sold Old Man's War, Tor asked me, do you have any other books? And I was like, well, I have Agent to the Stars, which I had written prior to that. And they're like, yeah, we're not going to take that. And part of it was because it was humorous. And they're like, humorous doesn't sell. You know, and it's just flat out, humor doesn't sell. So to actually get to the point where Red Shirts, we are marketing it as, this is funny. It basically took Old Man's War series plus The Agent to the Stars plus, it took me 8 books to get to the point where they could just say, this is a funny book.
Hmm. And I'm sorry, I'm just also thinking, I wrote a piece for Locus a few months ago on literary evolution and how people tend to think of evolution as a linear progress, which is not true at all. And I talked about how the real biological model of evolution, where there are all these niches and things go into them,
yeah.
how that actually works for fiction pretty well as a model, and I'm just thinking of that idea of something coming in and dominating its niche so much that nothing else can ever fill it.
Right, exactly.
You know, there will never be another shark at this point. Sharks are just so good at what they do.
Sharks are sharks, right, exactly. And
so it's
absolutely true, and we do as a, I think as a genre, if there's something that really, really works, then, I mean, and it's not really just our genre, it's everywhere. If something really works, you're like, then give me six more of that.
with humor and with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, one of the problems with that was it's a very specific, it was a very specific type of humor. You have to be a British farcist to do British farce.
Yes.
And there aren't that many British farcists. They're kind of thin on the ground, at least here in the United States. And so there was a lot of people attempting that sort of humor, and it was just failing, 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 and eventually it taints the whole thing. I've always put humor in the books because that's part of who I am. And I think that also... it's fun for people. I mean, and it's certainly fun to write in the sense of, like when I did Android's Dream, the first chapter of that is somebody farting someone else to death, right? And that was me, definitely. What is the most ridiculous thing I can think of, and can I pull it off? But that was, you know, it was a real challenge for me to do. But like I said, people sort of kept going with me on that, where I could introduce a little bit more, or a lot of the short stories that I did were meant to be funny. And, so I think it just gets to the point where eventually, if we're talking about evolution and all that sort of stuff, eventually, you know, the average life of a species is like a couple million years, and then it just kind of goes away. Sharks are phenomenally successful, but generally speaking, you know, there's still room for other fish in the sea, so to speak. And so what happens is eventually you get enough distance and time, and also, in our case, the genre expands enough that you are able to do more and different things. And so I do think between Red Shirts and also, you know, the ridiculous Hugo nomination of Shadow War of the Night Dragons, which I'm completely thrilled about. But I think that part of the reason that was nominated, aside from, you know, people being, you know, going, hot, click, was that that people were like, this is funny. This really is funny. And that's worth noting, you know, that's worth putting onto the ballot. And it's been really interesting to see the response to that, because some people are really excited that it's on a ballot, and some people are furious. How can that be on the ballot? It just goes to show that people aren't serious about their votes. Well, no, in fact, they are serious about their votes, and they're voting for the things that entertain them. They're voting for the things that make them feel good, that have given them some enjoyment. And it's certainly the case, you know, I'm very fortunate this year. I always believe that if you look at your category that you've been nominated for in a Hugo, and there's nobody that you'd be upset to lose to, then you've already won. I mean, I'm happy to lose my category if I lose. But, you know, but the fact of the matter is that it's really nice to see an overtly humorous piece being recognized for still being good.
Although it feels like humor is easier to do at short length than over a novel.
See, but it's not necessarily. The thing about humor is that it's very binary. It either works or it does not. Like I've said this before, if I've written a scene where I'm trying real hard to make you cry, if I don't succeed 100%, I will still make you get a lump in your throat, or I will still make you a little bit sad. And so it will still be effective in what it's trying to do.
Although I've seen some authors who go for the emotional manipulation at the end, I'm just pissed off.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there's...
It's still dependent on craft, absolutely. But you can... What I'm saying, though, is that in general, you can aim for, cry, land at lump and throat, and it still works. Now, on the other hand, if you are trying for, I'm going to make you laugh, and I fail, then it's just a complete failure. And not only have I not made you laugh, I've then annoyed you. Because you promised me a laugh. You did not make me laugh. You are not funny. And now I am angry at you because you said you would be funny and now you're not. And now I will stab you. And indeed, I think a lot of the people who have the negative reaction to Shadow War of the Night Dragons or to Red Shirts, because I've seen some magnificent one-star reviews for it, are literally, it's just like, I don't find this funny. And once you don't find it funny, then it progressively is not funny.
So either in short fiction or long fiction, anything longer than a joke is a risk. I mean, 3,000 words is okay to do. 80,000 words is a real challenge. And I think the secret for that, in the case of Red Shirts, is you have your, just like in Airplane, you have everybody in that universe play completely straight. You know, you have to, they have to be real people in the middle of a truly absurd situation trying to survive, and the humor comes out of that.
Cool. Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. Obviously, you're touring for the book Red Shirts. So you've got a story on the Hugo ballot. Is there anything else upcoming that you want people to know about?
Well, the Worldcon in Chicago. I'm going to be the toastmaster of that, and also the MC of the Hugos, which could be a little bit awkward.
That could be interesting. Have you checked? Has anyone been in that situation before where they might have to MC and accept a Hugo?
I don't know. I think maybe Connie Willis did it.
I was thinking Connie Willis
it was either Denver or it was Los Angeles, and I think that she was actually won that year that she was the MC. So, you know, there's precedent, but we will see what happens. But that's probably the biggest thing. I am working on a video game, but I can't describe anything about it yet. They're going to make a formal announcement about that. And right around Comic-Con, I will say this, right around Comic-Con, be looking for news from me because I'll have a pretty big announcement.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for coming down to Houston, and thank you very much for taking your time.
Glad to do it. Thank you.